This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Osama bin Laden continues to release threatening messages, we're going to take a look at the privileged family he comes from and the different ways inherited wealth and exposure to Western culture affected him and his siblings. That's 25 brothers and 29 sisters. They were the first bin Laden generation born in Saudi Arabia. Their father, Mohammed, emigrated from a remote town in Yemen and made his fortune as the royal family's contractor. My guest, Steve Call, is the author of the new book, The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his previous book, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden. Call is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a former reporter and managing editor at The Washington Post. He's president of the New America Foundation, a public policy institute. Steve Call, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, one thing that one of the many things that emerges in your book is that the father who built the bin Laden fortune, or his children who were involved in business, or his son Osama, who is the world's most famous terrorist, they were all global in their own way. I mean, his father's business was global. Osama's brother Salim's business was global, and Osama was a global terrorist. I mean, he has drawn on Islamists from around the Arab world.
I think that's exactly right. And that was, as I got into the research, the most striking theme. And what was remarkable was how early that pattern is visible in their experience over the course of the 20th century. The father who created this fortune, he was a migrant to Saudi Arabia from a remote part of Yemen, belonged to a diaspora that traveled widely, even in the era of sailing ships and colonial empires. And as early as the 1950s, he had agents in New York. He had engineers from Italy, consultants from the United States. He led groups of workers from all over the Arab and Islamic world. And one of his gifts was that he was a great leader of diverse followers, diverse workers, diverse executives, but always in the context of a unifying culture of Islam as defined by orthodoxy in Saudi Arabia. And I think a lot of that is visible in Osama's own career, though he employed these gifts for much different ends.
Well, and when we're talking about globalism, I mean, one of my favorite examples is one of Osama's brothers, Hassan bin Laden, who was heavily invested in the franchise, the Hard Rock Cafe Middle East.
It's just
like such an amazing story.
The extent to which these brothers, this generation of 25 brothers to which Osama belonged, made such varied choices simultaneously is just striking over and over again in the course of their narrative. And Hassan ends up buying the right to develop Hard Rock Cafe franchises in Kuwait and Beirut and Turkey. And you end up with these juxtapositions in the mid-90s where Hassan is opening a new Hard Rock Cafe in Beirut, and he's plastered the walls with John Lennon lyrics from songs like Imagine and rock and roll paraphernalia. And at the same time, just a few hundred miles away, his half-brother is collecting people and ideas to wage war against the very values that his brother is celebrating with fireworks and rock and roll. So that range of identities and choices within that generation to which Osama belonged, that's the real fascination, I think, of the larger story of the family.
Well, and I think one of the more interesting members of the bin Laden family is the oldest of the sons, Salim. And he studied in London. He loved the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. He wanted to sing. A friend of his in a band that he often sat in on married Emmylou Harris. And you write that Salim had a lot of business interests, but he really wanted to sing, and he'd often like pay to be able to sing at parties, including an Academy Award party. Can you talk a little bit about how Salim figures in to the bin Laden family?
Well, he was as enthusiastic about the West as Osama later proved hostile to it, and there's a streak of charisma in the bin Laden family. It's present in the father. It's very much present in Salim. He, for me as a researcher and a writer, proved to be such a gift. I had no idea that such a character resided in the bin Laden family. He was a pilot, an adventurer, a musician, a deceptively serious man, deceptive because his way of living was so full of fun and travel. He was a man who thought nothing of getting in one of his private planes and flying from Paris to New York to Texas to California, then back across the Pacific. And he organized around him a sort of entourage of like-minded aviators and rock and roll musicians, mechanics, and he was a very egalitarian character. He had no time for snobs or for social status. He was somebody who liked to play and do business, and in many ways he seemed very American in spirit, and he adapted to the American ethos with great ease. And he died in 1988, 2 months before Al-Qaeda was formed, and he was a very important influence in Osama's life. In fact, a collaborator with Osama during the anti-Soviet war. And many people today close to the family believe that if Salem had lived, 9/11 would never have happened because he was such a forceful personality and he had the kind of relationship with Osama, these people speculate, that would have led him eventually to intervene as Osama became increasingly radicalized and somehow prevent the history that did unfold from unfolding.
Osama and his oldest brother, Salem, are such interesting contrasts. You know, Salem's passions included business, music, and women. Did he have a lot of extramarital relationships?
Salem did, though he was also divorced during some of the periods of his cavorting. But he, you know, he was not someone who collected women in some pathological way. All of the women I was able to find who had been part of his life at one stage or another truly loved him, found him sweet and easy to be with. But he did have this Arabian fantasy that he could have multiple wives, and he adapted that fantasy to the West and at one point proposed simultaneously to four of his Western girlfriends, one American, one French, one German, and a fourth English, simultaneously at his mansion in London. And one of the women who was present provides a recollection on the record of how it went. And she's amazing in the way she tells it. She's a very likable person. And she just says, well, you know, I thought about it. Didn't seem like such a terrible idea. She was 22 or 23. And he was offering each of them a house of their own in Saudi Arabia with a flag from their country of origin flying in front. And each of them would receive a car from their own country. And this woman, the American, who was recounting it, said she thought to herself, well, this is no good. I don't really want a Cadillac, and this woman from Germany is going to get a Mercedes. It was this sort of fantasy world that Salem created wherever he went, and then which people somehow took seriously. And there is some kind of odd parallel between that and the fantasy world that Osama created that people around him also took seriously.
What do you see as the parallel?
Well, this charisma, this ability to create spaces, realities, to redefine the world, and also this way of living, as you said earlier, in a sort of borderless culture where none of the rules and none of the inherited lines on the map are to be accepted. And Solomon, his very secular, mobile, pilot adventurer, rock and roll musician way, he reinvented the map in which he lived. And Osama, in his Islamist, radicalized, anti-Western way, did something very similar.
Oh, here's another great contrast between Osama and his older brother, Salem. You know, Osama has made all these, like, terrorist videos warning about imminent destruction and Al-Qaeda attacks. And the multimedia thing that you write about that his brother Salem did was his hemorrhoid multimedia show. Would you just describe it?
Yes.
This seems so trivial in some ways, but it's just so fascinating.
Well, Salem was a great prankster, and he lived to entertain in a lot of ways. And this extended to every facet of his life. At some stage in the mid to late 80s, he required hemorrhoid surgery, and he became very self-dramatizing about this. He insisted on hiring some very experienced cardiovascular surgeon, someone with far more skill than is typically required for hemorrhoid surgery. But nonetheless, he insisted, and he went to New York at Columbia Presbyterian, and he had the surgery, and then he brought in cameras into the into the operating theater and filmed the whole episode from the point of view of his backside, and then took the video around Saudi Arabia and sort of shocked and entertained the royal family up to and including the king with displays of his own experience in hemorrhoid surgery. And there was this way in which he ingratiated himself with the Saudi royal family, which was a crucial business strategy for the bin Ladens because all financial favor flowed from the whim of the Saudi royals. And he ingratiated himself with them by essentially violating their sense of decorum by being outrageous, but doing it in a way that just worked somehow, that was funny, that people wanted to be around. And that sort of hemorrhoid video was something that a dozen people I met recounted the moment when he put it on the screen and how they felt and how people laughed. It was the way he lived.
Now, Salam died right before Osama bin Laden created al-Qaeda. But in the years before that, when Osama was working with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan trying to oust the Russians, did Salam, who was the businessman in the family, or one of the businessmen in the family, did he help Osama with money? Did he give him money to buy arms?
He did. He helped Osama in a number of ways. And it's remarkable to come across the sort of details of their collaboration because, as you've said before, they were such extraordinarily different characters. But what they had in common were several things. First, their business interests. The bin Ladens by the 1980s were essentially the Halliburton of Saudi Arabia. They were granted sole source contracts for sensitive defense and intelligence projects. In the 60s, they had built the defensive infrastructure that Saudi Arabia required during a war against Yemen. And their involvement in the Afghan war was similar. It was an entirely authorized Saudi project. In fact, it was in alignment with American foreign policy and intelligence policy at the time. So Osama on the Afghan frontier in the 1980s was essentially a representative of a business collaboration between the bin Ladens and the Saudi government. And so in that sense, Salam collaborated with him because it was part of the ordinary course of doing business. Yet they were involved in a war that was increasingly inflected with jihadi theology and ideology. And so you have dropping into this war a man, Salam, who brings with him rock and roll musicians and shaggy-haired mechanics and chain-smoking Swedes. And there are these marvelous scenes where they encounter Osama. Salam drives them up to the frontier or flies them up to the frontier, and Osama politely shakes hands with these sort of hippie-looking friends of Salam. Or in London, Salam arranges to sell weapons to Osama, brings Osama out to London luxury hotels in the late 1980s. This is something I certainly didn't have any hint of before doing this research. And as he goes into the meetings with the arms dealers, he has to say to his European friends, okay, now look, my brother is really, really religious, so no jokes, put your cigarettes out, treat me with respect. This is only going to last 45 minutes, but behave. And that was the nature of their collaboration with one another. But I think Osama looked upon Salam with great respect and, at least according to his mother and other sources, looked upon him with great affection as well, notwithstanding his very different lifestyle.
Salam was, among other things, a pilot, and he died in a plane crash when he was at the controls. And there were several other bin Laden children who are or were pilots. And, you know, the history of piloting and Salam's plane crash death made me wonder if there was any connection, consciously or unconsciously, in bin Laden's mind between how planes figured into his family and the fact that he used planes as weapons on 9/11.
Yeah, I try in the book not to go beyond where the evidence strictly leaves off, but I do think that the pattern of these events in Osama's life is very powerful. His father dies in a plane crash caused by an error by an American pilot. His eldest brother, who's providing him with financial and material aid in the late 1980s, then dies in a freak accident involving a recreational ultralight aircraft in San Antonio, Texas, just outside of San Antonio. Mysterious accident. I've investigated it. I've come to the conclusion that it was an accident, but an inexplicable one in many ways. And it would be an unusual Arabian who did not hold those events in mind and who did not wonder, certainly in the case of Salem's death, whether there were perhaps other explanations, a conspiracy to kill him for some reason. In fact, Osama's own brothers traveled to Texas to look into the matter themselves, suspecting that perhaps foul play had been involved. More broadly, there's, at a conscious or unconscious level, this pattern over and over again in bin Laden family life of aviation disasters involving Americans. And even beyond that specific theme, aviation and the power of mobility and the power of border crossing technology is obviously present in Osama's sense of himself as a terrorist leader and as a tactician. So it doesn't require a great leap for him to imagine and carry out a plot like that he pulled off on September 11th. To many Americans at that time, it seemed like an ingenious invention. But in fact, you can see that it's rooted in his own experience and in his own imagination, whether conscious or unconscious.
Osama bin Laden's father, Mohammed bin Laden, went from poverty in Yemen to being tight with the royal family in Saudi Arabia and creating a couple of really big, profitable enterprises, business enterprises. How did he first get tight with the royal family in Saudi Arabia as an outsider coming from Yemen?
Well, he arrived at the cusp of the Great Depression, and through most of the 30s and the very disruptive period of the Second World War, he basically hustled for a living as a small-time contractor and bricklayer, trained himself, began to develop the skills and the vision required to go into business on his own. It's really after the end of the Second World War, though, that he breaks out and that he ingratiates himself with the royal family. And he succeeds largely because he's willing to work in a way that the royal family requires and in a way where other construction companies from abroad, American companies like Bechtel, English companies, German companies, they can't deal with the whims and the idiosyncrasies of the Saudi royal family in the early days, in their kind of palace building phase, where they were essentially interested in surrounding themselves with personal luxuries and to a secondary extent only investing in national infrastructure. They worked in irregular ways. And Mohammed bin Laden essentially discovered how to perform as a kind of concierge service for the royal family. He accommodated them and gave them what they wanted. And in doing so, he essentially took business away gradually over the 1950s from the international corporations that had initially been invited in to start to build Saudi Arabia with its oil wealth. And the Saudis loved him because he was willing to accept late payments and do personal projects and be patient. And he was also one of their own, even though he was an immigrant. He was a Saudi figure increasingly, and I think the Saudi royal family took some pride in having created, in effect, an indigenous fortune of the sort he represented.
What were Mohammed bin Laden's greatest accomplishments?
He was a very successful businessman in the whole range of endeavor that Saudi Arabia undertook between the end of the Second World War and the mid-1960s. So this included building roads. It included building palaces and offices and all sorts of other infrastructure. But I think his greatest source of distinction was his position as the sole contractor for the three holiest cities in Islam, Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem, where he won contract after contract granted by the Saudi government, by religious authorities, and even by international religious authorities in Jerusalem to undertake sensitive renovations and improvements at these places of worship. His time in Jerusalem is particularly striking because he was granted, with the support of the Saudi government, contracts to renovate the Dome of the Rock, the third holiest site in Islam. And he did so with crews that included Catholics from Italy and religious Muslims from Saudi Arabia and Palestinians. He ended up owning property in Jerusalem. And he took, toward the end of his life, enormous pride in this status that he enjoyed as a sort of religious builder.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Call, author of the new book, The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. It's about the different ways Osama bin Laden and his siblings were affected by their inherited wealth and their exposure to Western culture. It's also about how their father, Muhammad, made his fortune. When we left off, Call was describing Muhammad's work as the sole contractor for the three holiest cities in Islam, Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. Muhammad also owned property in Jerusalem. This gets to something that you've discovered in your book that I don't think was known before, which is that Muhammad bin Laden owned land or real estate in Jerusalem, and after the 67 Arab-Israeli War was forced out. Tell us that story and how that figures into the bin Laden family.
Yeah, in a technical and a legal sense, essentially the bin Ladens are, in some small way, Palestinian refugees. They belong to the population that claims a right of return to Israel as a result of the territory that was taken in the 1967 war. He owned a house there and was able to find documents describing the contracting work that had brought him to Jerusalem, and then to trace the ownership of the house through interviews with Israeli citizens. And essentially, his property was taken over by Israeli land authorities after the 1967 war and then sold and resold. It was once owned by an Israeli naval officer, and it's now owned by an Arab citizen of Israel. And, of course, the bin Ladens are wealthy and ensconced in Saudi Arabia and are not in any meaningful way Palestinians. But it was striking to see that Osama's own repeated rhetorical claims to a piece of the Israel narrative were actually rooted in greater truth than I think has typically been presumed. In fact, a lot of analysts of Osama, myself among them in the past, have sort of ridiculed his attempts to claim allegiance with the Palestinian cause because it wasn't clear what purchase he had on that narrative and on those grievances. And the discovery that his father really was a Palestinian landowner is striking in at least a modest way.
While the father, Muhammad bin Laden, had contracts for the three holiest cities in the Muslim world, did his son, maybe this was long before Salem was living the kind of life of, rock and roll and sex and, you know, so on that he was living. But did Salem's life ever, was it ever considered to reflect badly on the family and their interests?
I think not. In the period where he was living that life, his choices, while exaggerated in some respects, were not unusual among young Saudis coming of age after the oil shock. This was a generation that after 1973, especially among privileged families like the bin Ladens, enjoyed sudden wealth and allowances, in the case of the bin Ladens, of a couple hundred thousand tax-free dollars a year in 1970s dollars, a lot of money. And they could essentially purchase any lifestyle they wanted. And many elite Saudis became initially fascinated by the choices and the freedom and the mobility and the pleasures available in the West. And so in some sense, Salem's journeys were representative of this period of exploration among many elites in Arabia and in the Gulf. And equally, Osama's revulsion and conservatism was emblematic of a pattern of resistance and reaction against the sudden advent of all of these freedoms and choices. What bound the bin Ladens together beyond business interests, though, was a really powerful sense of family belonging that really transcended all of these differences and of choice and of identity. And that, in the end, was one of the most striking things about them for me, was that despite these extraordinary differences among the 25 sons, the sense of belonging among them was even more powerful.
After Salem's death, when Osama founded al-Qaeda, what did his brothers and sisters think? Like, when they found out what Osama was up to, did they profoundly disagree with what he was doing? Did they try to distance themselves? Were they worried about how he would affect their business lives and their futures?
It's a subject that evolves over time. And in order to understand it, I think we have to start with the observation that at the time al-Qaeda was created by Osama in 1988, his work, his beliefs, his involvement in the Afghan war were all entirely orthodox in Saudi terms. This was a mainstream thing for him to be doing. Yes, his ardor and his puritanism graded and was more extreme than the form of Islam practiced by many of his brothers and sisters, but it was not out of bounds, and it certainly wasn't something that anyone would look at and call radical. He came home from the war, however, and began to say things that did sound a little radical. Not initially a complete break, but he started to question the authority of the Saudi royal family and its entitlement to rule over the Arabian Peninsula. And he protested the arrival of American troops in the kingdom to help expel Iraqi forces from Kuwait in 1990 and 1991. Gradually, he began to say and do things that put the family's interests in Saudi Arabia at risk. And what's interesting is at first, his brothers and to some extent his sisters essentially try to co-opt him. They say, Osama, look, we understand you have these views, but we have offices in Mecca and Medina, the holiest places in Islam. If you want to live a righteous life, go work as an executive there for us, and you can have it all. You can be more religious than the next person. You can practice your faith. You can preach, and you can make a good living in our construction company. And for a long while, that is to say for a period of 3 to 4 years, Osama seems intrigued by these possibilities of having it all. But eventually, his contact with radical networks and his own beliefs about the Saudi royal family lead him into exile. And gradually, by the mid-1990s, he breaks with his family, despite their entreaties, to come home and to calm down.
Now, you write that for years the bin Laden family invested in the obscure margins of the United States, the odd strip mall or the apartment complex. In about the time that you've been discussing, when they broke with Osama bin Laden, they started investing much more deeply in the United States. And one of the most famous bin Laden investments was in the Carlyle Group. And this was a private equity company, is a private equity company that the bin Ladens are no longer invested in. But because of their connection and because George H.W. Bush, James Baker, Frank Carlucci, and a lot of other prominent Americans who have been involved in politics have also been involved in the Carlyle Group, there's been a lot of theories and even conspiracy theories about the Carlyle Group that have circulated since 9/11. How did the bin Laden family become invested in the Carlyle Group?
They had a business contact, an investment banker of Iraqi origin who helped Carlyle find potential passive investors in their big sort of hedge funds and equity funds. And I think he put the bin Ladens in touch with them. It was the natural kind of vehicle for the bin Ladens. They lived in a society, Saudi Arabia, where elite contacts and personal contacts at the top of government were the key to successful business. I think they sort of transposed that theory of business onto the United States and sought out opportunities to embed themselves with elite families and elite institutions. So they made big charitable contributions to Harvard University and any fund that was being promoted by James Baker or George H.W. Bush was appealing because of the kinds of connections to the top of American society that it offered. They made a series of investments in Carlyle equity funds in the mid-1990s and then were visited by James Baker and President Bush as they came out to the Middle East to cultivate investors and to just provide access to those who were involved with Carlyle. I don't think there was much of an operating relationship. They didn't really do deals together or stay up all night around the conference table trying to figure out what business to go into. They were essentially hedge fund investors before these things were called hedge funds.
Still, it's just kind of hard to imagine that people really in the know like George H.W. Bush and James Baker would be highly placed people in a private equity company that included the bin Laden family after knowing about Osama bin Laden, even though Osama bin Laden had become like the black sheep of the family.
Well, there was a sort of mutual advantage in this alliance between these two families, the Bushes and the bin Ladens, as well as their lawyers like James Baker. I think on the American side, these people were convinced that most of the bin Ladens were innocent of Osama's radicalism and so were entitled to legal representation. For instance, Baker and Botts, James Baker's law firm, represented the bin Laden family before the American government at the time that Osama started to conduct violent operations against American targets. They privately went into meetings with the FBI and offered advice about how to defend bin Laden family interests from the jeopardy that Osama might create in the form of economic sanctions or other trouble. So the certainly James Baker had no qualms about partnering with that portion of the bin Laden family that said it had repudiated Osama. And equally, the bin Ladens used their contacts with not just Baker and Bush, but also with Jimmy Carter and, as I said earlier, Harvard University and other places where they made large charitable contributions as just a kind of hedge, as a demonstration that the bin Ladens were not all of Osama's view or that they did not share his attitude towards the United States. And I think it was an awkward way to sort of hedge your bets. But from the distance of Jeddah, it looked like the best way to try to persuade the American government that the bin Ladens were not all the same.
The bin Laden family, you know, largely a business family, lots of money. Meanwhile, you know, Osama is organizing al-Qaeda and preparing attacks against the United States. He needed a lot of money to keep al-Qaeda going. How much money did he have from the bin Laden family business interests?
You know, a lot less than the American government believed right up to 9/11. It was sort of astonishing to find that the answer to that question was actually sitting around in open American civil court files in Los Angeles County Superior Court. There was a divorce case in the early 1990s involving one of Osama's half-brothers and an American wife. And this ex-wife believed that she wasn't being told the truth about her husband's income, and so she sent a forensic accountant to Saudi Arabia to investigate family finances. And this accountant came back and reported to the court accurately that each of the brothers received about $300,000 to $400,000 in basic dividends each year, and that they might make more in salaries if they worked in the company, and that their principal inheritance was only in the range of $8 to $15 million. And this information was essentially sitting in an archive in Los Angeles throughout the 1990s. But as recently as late as 2000, the CIA was reporting to President Clinton and to the cabinet that was trying to reckon with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda that he had a fortune of $300 million. And so unfortunately, U.S. policy sort of proceeded throughout the period before 9/11 from a mistaken assumption, which was that Osama had the money to self-fund. And in fact, he was much more dependent upon continuous fundraising and much more vulnerable to disruption than the American government understood.
One of the stories surrounding September 11th, in which there's a lot of speculation and even conspiracy theories, is how the members of the bin Laden family who were in the United States on September 11th were given the right to fly out of the country on chartered planes at a time when all the airports were shut and no one else was flying anywhere. What did you learn about how they got out?
Well, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar Sultan, made the call to the White House and to the FBI and made the arrangements, not just for the bin Ladens, but for some members of the Saudi royal family who happened also to be in the United States at the time. It's a myth that aviation was shut down, but there were nonetheless special arrangements made for these charter flights. And the flight bearing the bin Ladens started in Los Angeles, went through Orlando, Washington, and Boston, and collected three or four of Osama's generation and many of the children of that generation. The scene aboard the plane was the most remarkable discovery. The pilot and crew didn't know they had bin Ladens, revolted at one stage, demanded more money. And at the end, you have these this kind of mournful family reunion taking place aboard a plane that was outfitted for a sports team, everyone chain-smoking, and some of the young college students complaining that they'd just gotten fake IDs that would have allowed them to enjoy Boston more than in their previous years at school, all being flown eventually over the Atlantic and back to Saudi Arabia.
And the pilot and crew didn't find out until the bin Laden family got on who the passengers were going to be. And you say Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia contacted the FBI and Richard Clark and got approval.
He did. And he was, you know, he was very well connected to the White House and to the FBI. And Clark and the FBI have emphasized that they went over the manifests and conducted interviews with many of the bin Ladens on the plane. I didn't find in my own review of this evidence that they'd allowed anybody to leave who was a subject of continuing interest, with one possible exception. There was a passenger on the flight who seems to have been involved with a charity in Northern Virginia that had previously been investigated by the FBI. He seems to have been the only person who was aboard the flight who might, you know, by objective assessment, have warranted additional questioning. But everybody else was vetted and had no connection to Islamist movements of any kind.
Osama bin Laden signed his last will and testament on December 14th of 2001. So this is just a few months after the 9/11 attacks. And in it, he advises his children not to work with al-Qaeda. You say he cites the story of a Muslim leader who forbid his son from becoming a caliph, saying, "If it is good, then we have had our share. If it is bad, then it is enough." I found it so interesting that in his last will and testament, he would tell his children not to become members of al-Qaeda. What do you make of that?
Well, one of the few sort of humanizing themes in Osama's biography is the tension that he repeatedly feels and expresses about his family life, to which he is very fully devoted, more than 20 children and four wives, and pretty attentive and doting father for a militia leader with terrorist ambitions. The tension between that and his role as an exile living a life of a sort of war-fighting hardship. And this moment in late 2001 was his darkest hour. He was under bombardment. He thought he would certainly be killed or captured. And I think he was giving his family permission to go and live a different life from that which he had ultimately chosen.
Will you just allow me one brief moment of cheap psychology
sure.
before you have to leave? And that is, you know, Osama bin Laden is all about like attacking the West for its corrupt values. And in some ways, those are the values of his own family. I mean, you know, his so many members of his family have lived in the West. His brother is so into some several, at least two of his brothers are so into rock and roll. And Osama bin Laden attacks the symbol of the global financial industry, the World Trade Center. Well, you know, his family was so invested in the Carlyle Group, this big international private equity company. So in some ways, like his attacks, they're attacking his own family. I mean, it's the values of his own family.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most frustrating thing about him from a biographer's point of view is that he is so persistently silent about these questions. And the silence itself is suggestive that there is a lot of interesting material there. What we can say for certain is that he had ambition within the family, and he clearly seems at times to have been resentful that he didn't become the leader of the bin Laden family and the bin Laden business. And his pursuit of his own ambitions is at least partially a chance for him to prove who he was and what he was capable of vis-a-vis his brothers. As to the values issue, you know, clearly he is censorious about anyone who chooses to live what he regards as an un-Islamic life, and that includes his brothers. At the same time, he has a view of sin that is in some way accommodating of wayward choices by family members, that he does repeatedly say, it's not my business to judge another man's conduct. That God will do on Judgment Day. I can only urge my brother to get on the right path before it's too late. And so I don't think that he is attacking America because he feels some deep personal revulsion about his family's sort of cultural choices and needs to sort of purge them. I think that it is political. And also there is an element of resentful ambition and stubbornness that is born of his beliefs about who he was and who he might have been in Saudi Arabia if only they'd understood him, if only they'd given him the keys to the kingdom.
I wish we had a whole lot more time to talk, but unfortunately we don't. But before you go, I do want to ask you, where do you think bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, is now, and what do you think he's up to?
Well, we can see the what he's up to part from his periodic video and audio statements. He's clearly living among friends. He has access to news, probably satellite television, the internet. He's reading books about American foreign policy. He was educated in English at his prep school, and I imagine in this long exile he's renewed his acquaintance with English and is reading books in the English language. And I think he's in Pakistan. It's conceivable that he's in an urban area, but more likely he's in some mud-walled compound in the territory along the border with Afghanistan, where he has long roots and many friends. And I do think that it's more likely now, in the next year or two, that he'll finally be captured or killed than at any time since late 2001. I say this not because American efforts to find him have improved. I don't think they have. But the situation in Pakistan has changed dramatically in the last 6 or 8 months. He's now a much more unpopular figure than he was even a year ago. And also the new government has a different set of motivations to find him in comparison to the government of President Musharraf.
So even though the new government is less friendly with the Bush administration than Musharraf was, you think the new government in Pakistan is going to do a better job going after al-Qaeda and bin Laden?
They have better motives to do so. The United States got itself into a strange situation with Musharraf in which the structure of its aid to the Pakistan government essentially incented the government not to find bin Laden, because if they found him, they had reason to fear that the U.S. would end this flow of more than $10 billion that it was providing directly to the army. The Democratic government came to power arguing to Washington that constitutional democracy was a better counterterrorism strategy than reliance on an authoritarian military leader. And so I think they understand that if they can deliver Osama, they're not going to be punished for it. Rather, they're going to be rewarded. And so for the first time, at least you have somebody in the Pakistani government who has motivation to find him. And at the same time, the population in which he's hiding has turned more hostile to him. And so the possibility of someone dropping a dime on him is much greater now than it was a couple of years ago.
Are you expecting another al-Qaeda attack against the United States in the near future?
Well, they're clearly trying. There's a whole series of conspiracies that have surfaced in Europe that are coming out of this Afghan frontier area. The most important of those is one that Americans know very little about, which was the conspiracy in August of 2006 to blow up aircraft over the Atlantic Ocean. This is the one that caused flyers to no longer be able to carry their toothpaste aboard. And if that plot had succeeded, it involved an attempt to blow up 12 planes, probably would have been 4,000 people dead, mostly British and American. And now the British broke it up before it could go forward. I don't know what the chances of its success were, but it's an indication that al-Qaeda still has ambitions and networks. And it probably suggests that it's not so easy for them to work directly on American soil, that they'll try to get at the United States through Europe, where they seem to be able to operate more effectively.
Well, Steve Kohl, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thanks very much for having me.
Steve Kohl is the author of the new book, The Bin Ladens. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and president of the New America Foundation. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.